Good morning, campers. Heidi, hi. Excellent. Thank you, Richard. I'll just say a very few words. I'm David Feldman, the director of the PEZ Institute here at Birkbeck. There are, a few people here who I'm glad to see are joining us for the first time in this conference. I'll just make a few introductory remarks. Some of you will have a sense of déjà entendu, but I hope you will bear with me. This is the third day now of a three-day conference on the history of boycotts. The conference over the last 2 days has ranged widely. The papers we heard were consistently excellent, and the same thing should be said of the quality of discussion. The papers dealt with subjects that were uncomfortable sometimes as well as intriguing, whether the refusal of the leaders of American universities to support a boycott of Nazi Germany in the 1930s, or the difficulties that boycott movements have had in achieving their ostensible goals, whether we look at the Polish lands in the early 20th century or the campaign against Nestlé powdered milk in the 1970s. It is precisely because boycotts are a difficult and uncomfortable subject that I am grateful that you are all here today. And not least does the difficulty and discomfort arise, perhaps, when we come to consider the BDS movement, which of course is a focus of our discussions today. On the web, this conference has been dismissed on the one hand as an exercise in Hasbara, Israeli propaganda, and on the other hand as a form of academic treachery against Israel. Of course, it is neither of these things, and the fact that you are here speaks volumes in that respect. Collectively, you are a diverse group, bringing varied empirical, disciplinary, theoretical, and political perspectives to bear on your scholarship. It would be impossible to get you to speak with one voice, even if I had that bizarre ambition. The academic conference is a different space to the web. The rules of engagement are different. Arguments take a logical form, there are rules of evidence, and crucially, we assume others are speaking in good faith, even when we disagree with them profoundly. And I'm thrilled that you have all come together in this joint enterprise for the rest of this day. And I think I will leave those remarks there and hand over to my colleague, Hilary Sapir, who will be chairing our first session today.
This morning, I'm Hilary Sapir. I'm also in the Department of History, Classics and Archaeology at Birkbeck. And it's my pleasure to introduce today's panel speakers this morning to you and tell you a little bit about them. The panel is After Apartheid, the Politics, Rhetoric and Economics of Boycott. And we have three fascinating papers, the first by Lee Jones, Sanctioning Apartheid, Comparing South Africa and Israel BDS Campaigns. Lee Jones is in the Department of International Politics at Queen Mary, University of London, who works on the politics of sovereignty, intervention, social conflict, political economy and state transformation in developing countries. He's currently involved in a three-year ESRC-funded project that explores how international sanctions affect target states by tracing their influence on the local political economy and struggles between contending socio-political coalitions. He has published in journals, and there are forthcoming articles too, such as International Studies Quarterly, Conflict Security and Development, and the Review of International Studies. He's also recently published a book with Palgrave Macmillan on sovereignty and intervention in Southeast Asia. Our second speaker is Ilke Schroeder, who will be talking on why BDS activists portray Israel as an apartheid state. Ilke Schroeder herself has been an activist who has campaigned against racism long before she became involved in challenging anti-Semitism, both of which she did in her work with the European Parliament between 1999 and 2004. But she's now currently engaged in academic research as a PhD candidate and with her work on the link between anti-Semitism and national identity. Our final speakers, we have two presented the last two paper, are Jan Adstemmet and Yehonatan Alsher, both based at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein. And their paper is entitled The Best of Intentions, Profiteering and a Self-Congratulatory Narrative, Reviewing the Effects of the Economic Sanctions Against Apartheid South Africa. Jan Adstemmet is a senior lecturer in the Department of History at the University of the Free State, whose work has ranged over the history of poverty in South Africa, freedom of speech, as well as the end of apartheid and the transition to a new democratic dispensation. He's written two books, one on the Afrikaans press and one on South African film. He's accompanied in his talk by Yehonatan Alsher, who is based as a postdoctoral fellow also at the University of the Free State, whose doctoral dissertation at Tel Aviv University was engaged in the political intellectual origins of the United Nations Genocide Convention. So without further ado, I call on our speakers to speak to you.
Thank you and good morning. This paper is a critical political analysis of the analogy that Palestinian BDS campaigners make with South Africa. The South African comparison, the analogy, is absolutely central to the BDS campaign. The 2005 BDS call explicitly references South Africa and says that we are inspired by the South African experience, and it demands, on the basis of moral consistency, that everybody understand that apartheid is happening in Israel. So for moral consistency, we should treat Israel in the same way we treated South Africa. And there are hundreds of references to South Africa and its experience in the activist literature. Now, there's nothing unusual about this framing of a contemporary struggle using past conflicts. You can go back as far as Karl Marx, writing the 18th Brumaire. He noted the dominance of the poetry of the past during the 1848 Paris Commune, where revolutionaries anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past to their service, borrowing from them names, battle slogans, and costumes in order to present this new scene in world history in time-honoured disguise and borrowed language. And many sanctions activists have actually referred to South Africa and tried to present their struggle as a repeat, almost, of the South African experience. Now, that analogy is normal and it's long-standing, but it carries real risks. And Marx continued that the awakening of the dead in early revolutions was justified insofar as it served the purpose of glorifying the new struggles, not of parodying the old, of magnifying the given task in the imagination, not recoiling from its solution in reality, of finding once more the spirit of revolution, not making its ghost walk again. So as he suggests, the invocation of revolutions past can play a useful purpose, but it could also potentially distract people from considering what is new, what is different about the contemporary conflict, and distract people struggling against oppression today from the urgent tasks of the present. And that is basically what I want to argue in this paper, that the South African analogy is not fully appropriate, not on the grounds of the alleged moral similarity between the two targets. I don't deal with that in that paper, and I think we're going to get a paper on that in a moment. But more in terms of the nature of the South African and Palestinian liberation movements. So specifically, I want to make three arguments. One is that in South Africa, BDS was a tool that was used by a powerful, strategically minded, well-led liberation struggle that by the 1980s had successfully mobilized the masses towards its concrete and long-held, clearly articulated goals. In Palestine, BDS is intended to create such a movement where one such as that does not exist. And that, I think, is asking too much of BDS. And it misreads what BDS did for South Africans and also elsewhere. The second argument is that lacking the ANC's clarity of analysis and of the political and political economy context that they're operating in, and the mechanisms by which BDS is meant to contribute to the emancipation of Palestinians, Palestinian BDS activists are confused or divided over both the goals of BDS, or the ultimate goals that they're actually seeking in their campaign, and the mechanisms by which BDS is supposed to transform their situation. The third point I want to make is that activists therefore end up with a confused sense of the means-end relationship, where BDS becomes an end in itself and successes, spurious successes, are identified simply by the achievement of BDS measures. Okay, so let me first outline a basic view of what I think the ANC thought about sanctions. We heard yesterday from Simon that external sympathisers may have been rather confused about the strategic basis for BDS, but my reading of the ANC suggests that they weren't quite so confused, because they had a very clear analysis of the apartheid regime, rooted in the interests of certain classes and ethnic groups, and grounded fundamentally in a Marxist and anti-colonial analysis. And so they saw the regime as being underpinned by a certain set of very powerful societal forces, and they saw opposition groups as being fragmented and divided. The basic task to get rid of apartheid was to fragment the ruling bloc that underpinned the regime and strengthen, cohere, and mobilize the anti-apartheid forces. So basically a class struggle type model. And they had a very clear idea about how they were going to go about this. This was the so-called four pillars of the liberation campaign: mass mobilization, underground political work, the armed struggle, and international solidarity work. And the ultimate goal behind which they tried to mobilize everybody was the 1955 Freedom Charter, which set out a democratic socialist vision for a future South African state. In accordance with that very clear analysis, clear strategy, they had a very clear sense of where BDS fitted into that strategy. They were part of this fourth pillar, the international solidarity pillar. And if you go to speeches at the time, or texts, or if you interview ANC leaders, people like Oliver Tambo, Thabo Mbeki, Mac Maharaj, Alec Irwin from COSATU, they had quite a coherent view of how they expected sanctions to work for them as a mechanism to assist their liberation struggle. The idea was basically threefold. One, it would restrain the regime's capacity to suppress the opposition. Second, it would divide the alliance of forces behind the apartheid state. And third, it would broaden the anti-apartheid support base. So BDS was meant to have concrete and material effects on the forces locked in struggle over power in the South African state, meant to tilt the balance of forces in favour of the forces struggling for liberation. And they were very clear that BDS could only ever serve as a supplementary aspect to the struggle. It was never going to be primary, it was never going to be determinant. The key aspect was always mass mobilisation, although the role of armed struggle kind of went up and down over time too. So Abdul Minty, for example, who was a leading force in the anti-apartheid movement in this country, stated, "Victory will come through the struggle of the people of South Africa. Sanctions must be regarded as a complement to that struggle." And moreover, mass mobilisation was key to making sanctions bite. In the absence of mass mobilisation, sanctions did not work. There were arms and oil embargoes imposed on South Africa from the 1960s and 1970s onwards, and the South African state was able to evade those at great cost, because it was always able to deflect the costs of evading those sanctions onto, or extract the means for financing this evasion onto, the oppressed population. And it was only when you had sustained mass mobilization in the 1980s that there was a basic trade-off for the regime. Yes, you could keep oppressing the opposition, and that might retain short-term order, but in the long term, you were facing a revolutionary situation if you could not improve their welfare and undercut the basis for mass mobilization. But you couldn't do that if your resource base was being squeezed, including by sanctions, but also the broader context of the economic crisis. So what you start to see is what they expect to see, is the fragmentation of the apartheid ruling bloc. And the key force that I think is important here was the splitting off of big business from the pro-apartheid bloc and their move to promote reform and negotiations with the ANC. So that's a very crude sketch of what the ANC thought about sanctions. How does this differ from the Palestinian BDS campaign? The first is that Palestinian BDS call is not an expression of a powerful, coherent revolutionary movement with a popular mass following, but is an attempt to bring such a movement into being. Now, the context here is clearly the decline, and some might even say death, of the Palestinian liberation movement. The PLO was once seen as being at the vanguard of a worldwide revolutionary struggle against imperialism and colonialism. But since the 1970s, it's been progressively abandoned by its Arab and radical fellow travellers. And we've seen, crucially, the taming or the co-optation of the Palestinian leadership through the peace process. Many Palestinians are now extremely cynical about that process. The Palestinian leadership is seen to have abandoned the liberation struggle and got absorbed into day-to-day administration. There's a focus on development promoted by the international financial institutions and the systematic corruption of a class of Palestinian politicians, businessmen and intellectuals. There's been Israeli repression of grassroots political organizations and the NGOization of grassroots organization, the depoliticization of that movement through NGOization, and a loss of confidence in both NGOs and the political leadership. And then, of course, the Hamas-Fatah split since 2006 and the profound disarray of the PLO. So the situation as described by one former PLO official is that every institutional overarching structure that once united Palestinians has now crumbled and been swept away. No single body is able to claim legitimately to represent all Palestinians, no body able to set out a collective policy or national program of liberation. There is no plan. We are an idea in our history of resistance. So what is BDS meant to do? Activists say they hope that BDS, the BDS core, will recreate a sense of unity and purpose that has been lost since the 80s, to create a basis on which to campaign and limit sectarianism for organizations unable to present a stronger platform. These are all quotations from the literature itself. Now, can BDS do this? It seems to me unlikely. Because of the lack of consensus, the divided nature of the Palestinian opposition today, the BDS call is a very thin, lowest common denominator platform with just three rights-based goals: the end of the occupation, full equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and the right to return for refugees. There is no political end goal at all. But even so, with this thinness of goals, there's still no consensus. The Comprador Palestinian business elite are hostile to BDS for obvious reasons, and it took 5 years for the Palestinian National Authority to even sign up to BDS in a limited way, and they still only endorse a limited settlements boycott. So it has not recreated the unity that they hoped it would. And it was never clear anyway how an international activist campaign in Western countries was supposed to resolve the internal splits within the Palestinian movement. Crucially, it didn't do this in South Africa. The crucial dynamic that allowed the ANC to attain leadership and move forward was urbanization of the black population, the explosion of a black working class, unionization, mass mobilization on the ground by various different forces. Now, Palestinian activists recognize that the South African treatment requires sanctions from outside combined with mass mobilization from within, but they provide no means by which this mass mobilization is to be achieved. Urbanization, unionization, and organized working class cannot serve as the basis for the Palestinian liberation movement, because its significance to the Israeli economy has declined substantially since the 1980s. And also, sanctions didn't create the basis for opposition to apartheid in South Africa. As we heard yesterday in relation to the Montgomery bus boycott, South Africans did not need external forces to encourage them to struggle against apartheid. They asked for support for an ongoing active liberation struggle. And also, sanctions were divisive in South Africa. The white opposition did not approve of sanctions, and neither did some black elite forces, Inkatha, Chief Buthelezi, and so on. And they were also divisive in other contexts, such as Iraq, where they divided the opposition very profoundly from 1994 onwards, and also Myanmar or Burma. So the second point, there is, as a result of this kind of hollowing out of strategic leadership and vision, we see confusion over the end goals and confusion over the mechanisms supposed to achieve these goals. And these are absolutely fundamental in terms of the goals. There is no agreement on whether even they favour a one-state or a two-state solution. And so without some kind of substantive consensus or substantive vision, it's very difficult to build a wider societal backing for a movement, I think. There is also confusion over the mechanisms by which BDS is meant to produce change on the ground. Crawford and Klotz's study of South Africa suggests four basic mechanisms by which sanctions could work. One is compellence. So BDS increases the cost of objectionable policies, and so policymakers do a revised cost-benefit analysis and discard the objectionable policy. The second is normative communication. So BDS signals your disapproval of these policies and persuades the policymakers to change their behavior. The third is resource denial. So BDS deprives the target of the resources that it needs to continue the objectionable policy. And the fourth is political fracture. So BDS stimulates political change domestically, a legitimacy crisis, dissent in the target state, leading to a change of government and therefore an abandonment of the objectionable policies. Now, as I said earlier on, the primary means by which the ANC saw things working was political fracture. Even resource denial, the idea that you might be able to deprive the state of its means to continue the policies, could only make sense in the context of political fracture, of mass mobilization. That was the thing that would deprive the state of its capacity to keep repressing the population for fear of revolution. And it had very little time, I think, indeed, for normative communication, despite all the claims that are made today about the sports boycott and so on. Now, Palestinian BDS activists don't articulate any coherent vision of the way that sanctions are supposed to work, but they suggest various different means that can be fitted into this fourfold category. There's lots of talk about raising awareness or challenging the legitimacy of the Israeli occupation, but it's not ever clear how that is supposed to lead to change, the mechanisms by which that might lead to change. Now, it could be part of a two-stage strategy. We heard yesterday that many of the early boycotts in the anti-apartheid movement didn't intend to create a change directly in South Africa. The target was not actually South Africa, it was the publics of Western states to try and build consensus for real sanctions that would then later damage the South African state. So it would be possible to put this raising awareness thing into a first stage of a two-stage strategy. For example, to achieve the withdrawal of US aid that might actually lead to then resource denial. But it's rarely articulated in this way. But we have to think about chains of events that are supposed to be produced by sanctions that would lead to change on the ground. Other activists don't adopt this two-stage approach, but they think sanctions should have direct effects immediately. But they're divided here again on how they think this might happen. And here you can see all these four mechanisms suggested. One, normative communication, persuasion, the re-education of Israelis in particular. But most people actually dismiss this and say the point is pressure and coercion. So the second then is compellence. The idea is to raise the cost of the occupation. And there are problems with this because sanctioned states often absorb vast costs to pursue desired political ends. So the oil embargo in South Africa alone costs $35 billion to evade. And that was absorbed until there was mass mobilization and economic crisis at a profound level that made that continued expenditure impossible. But again, we don't see that on the ground in Israel. The third is resource denial. So there's an idea that if you do disinvestment, you do trade embargoes, you might cut off the funding used to sustain the occupation. Or if you put an arms embargo on Israel, it won't be able to continue its war crimes. That's plausible only if the Israeli system of rule really does depend on external flows. And that's often asserted by activists, but it's never proven. So it's true, for example, that Israel gets $3 billion worth of aid each year from the United States. A lot of that is spent on arms imports, but it also has an extremely large domestic arms industry, and it exports $7 billion worth a year. So it seems very unlikely, even if sanctions were imposed, that Israel would run out of weapons. So this logic of resource denial seems quite flawed. The fourth is political fracture. So the idea is that, just as we saw in South Africa, we've seen it all before in South Africa, somebody says, Israel's will desire normalcy if they're bombarded by all these punishments. They'll stop supporting apartheid, they'll mobilize against it, and so we'll see political fracture. The problems with this are twofold. First is, activists are divided over whether BDS actually is directed at Israelis or not. And there's a quote in the paper where one person says, oh, BDS is addressed to the Israeli public, and another BDS activist says, BDS is not directed to the Israeli public. So they just simply don't agree on this. And there is a considerable suspicion among some quarters of the BDS campaign about whether you can even trust Israeli sympathizers. There might be these left Zionists that are trying to hijack the BDS campaign to save Israel as an apartheid state. Secondly, there is confusion over the South African analogy. It's not true to suggest that sanctions ever generated a significant anti-apartheid movement among whites, as is often suggested. There was never a mass-based anti-apartheid movement among whites. The most important shift was that, as I said, of big business increasingly distancing themselves from the National Party regime. Now, you could conceive of sanctions as doing something like this in the Israeli context. Targeting sanctions at particularly powerful, influential groups who are important structurally, economically, politically. But since there's no ideological framework, no political analysis, no political economy analysis within the campaign, there's no sense of what it is that allows this system to maintain itself, what are the key forces, and therefore what might disrupt this system. The closest person coming to this is Shir Hever, the Israeli economist, who suggested that large-scale conglomerates are the key force underpinning the current Israeli state. They're the ones that are financing it, and they should be targeted in order to try and produce this fracturing effect. And so if you want to do that, then you need to target BDS at creating maximal economic damage on those particular firms' interests. But because there is no overall strategy, whatever he might say, it's left entirely up to foreign campaigners to decide how BDS is supposed to work and what targets to choose. And that's where the strategic incoherence that I've been talking about really tells in practice, where this is not just about me showing up inconsistencies within text, but it has real political consequences. Many groups focus on high-profile firms operating in the occupied territories, which are either particularly abusive or involved in resource extraction and so on. Now, that might make sense if you're thinking about this as a two-stage strategy, awareness raising to build support for meaningful sanctions later. But then we shouldn't expect targeting those companies to have economic damage. So you won't get compellence, resource denial, political fracture on that basis, because the target is not actually Israeli society, the target is Western society. But if your goal is, as Hever suggests, for example, to inflict maximal economic damage on core conglomerates, then targeting your efforts on these settlements firms is a waste of time, because their output is economically marginal and they are also politically not very influential. So rather than adapting the tactics to the context of Western activists, as is often suggested, it seems much more sensible to me to adapt them to the context in Israel-Palestine. So the final point is the confusion between means and ends. Now, it seems fairly clear to me and to also some Palestinian activists that BDS is a means to an end. It's not an end in its own right. But because end goals are not defined in this campaign and the means to achieve them are very confused and fuzzy, you get a blurring of the distinction between means and ends. And activists end up suggesting that the achievement of BDS measures is the end goal and the BDS campaign is the means, rather than BDS being the means to achieve political change in Israel-Palestine. And activists end up celebrating the achievement of these measures as successes in their own right, despite the fact that they appear to have no impact on the ground. Of course, activists need to tell celebratory stories about their own achievements to keep their morale up and keep going. But for political reasons, for strategic planning reasons, it's very important to make a very clear means-end distinction and to measure progress towards final end goals to enable constant reflection on the efficacy of particular strategies and tactics for achieving what you want to achieve. So the real metric is not the number of BDS measures, but the extent to which they filter through into emancipating Palestinians. And that's particularly important because 8 years into this campaign, many BDS activists suggest the situation for Palestinians is worse than ever. So to conclude, what recommendations or priorities would I draw out from this discussion? The first is clearly the most urgent task remains the rejuvenation, the reunification of the Palestinian liberation movement. In the interim, the BDS National Committee may need to assume much more directive strategic leadership to agitate to develop strategic substantive goals, to develop a plausible strategy for achieving them and specify the expected contribution of BDS tactics. Activists and scholars can help provide analysis and ideas, and many South African scholars during apartheid provided extremely sophisticated analysis that was very useful to this goal. We're only starting to scratch the surface with Israel-Palestine. But ultimately, these external groups will need to submit to Palestinian authority and leadership. The third is, I think we need to be very careful about how the South African analogy is used. Its main force is moral. But the supposed moral similarity between two targets tells us absolutely nothing about their relative susceptibility to sanctions. Because there are massive differences in political economy, social structure, and so on, the targets differ so much that even if you impose identical BDS measures on two states, you will get very different results. So we must, in using the South African analogy, avoid parodying the old and just trying to rejuvenate the ghost of the South African revolution and concrete, and focus instead on the concrete needs of the present. Thank you.